force. And he completely shunted them aside, pushed Nixon forward to as aggressive but covert a policy as possible to make Allende fail, to destabilize Allende's ability to govern, to create what Kissinger called a coup climate. In the new edition of the Pinochet file, we have the actual transcript of Nixon and Kissinger's conversation, their first phone conversation after the coup took place, in which Nixon says to Kissinger, "Well, our hand doesn't show in this one, does it?" And Kissinger said, "We didn't do it," referring to direct participation in the coup. "We helped them," he says. "I mean, we helped them. Blank," which I'm sure is a reference to the CIA, "created the conditions as best as possible." And this is the first conversation between Nixon and Kissinger after the coup. They're basically laying out the role of the United States in creating a coup climate in Chile, facilitating the coup. But it's even worse. This was long before your program existed, but Richard Nixon is already complaining about the liberal crap in the media. And Kissinger says, "Yeah, the media is bleeding because a communist government was overthrown." They, you know, like as if the media is on the side of Allende. They're focusing on the atrocities that are taking place. And Kissinger says, "In the Eisenhower period, we would be heroes."
In this last minute, Juan Garces, it is interesting, though, you experienced the intensity of what happened 40 years ago with Salvador Allende ultimately killing himself in the palace as the bombs rained down. You are focused on today and what is happening today. You brought Pinochet to justice. You had Baltasar Garzon, through the famous Spanish judge, issue an arrest warrant for him when he took a visit to London, and he was held there, although ultimately sent back to Chile. What lesson can we learn in this last 25 seconds? And we'll continue the conversation after the show.
It's a matter of how do you understand the world should go, through peaceful means or using bombs and invasions. The law is very clear. Since 1945, the United Nations Charter, after a big world war, decided that the sovereignty and independence of the country should be respected, and that all the nations should fight to avoid genocidal policies.
We have to leave it there, but part two we'll post at democracynow.org. Juan Garces, Spanish lawyer, ex-aide to Salvador Allende and Peter Kornbluh, the latest book, The Pinochet File. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, and also heard around the web at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5:02. Up next is the KBOO Evening News, right after these messages.
Hi, this is Ren Green with the latest episode of my KBOO podcast, Experience Points. This week, I talked with bipolar peer support specialist Gina Wheeler about mental illness and peer counseling.
I just want everybody that has a mental illness to know that there is more out there than just that medical model, that there's hope, there's help, there's support. And tapping into that community, you can really find how to live your life and not just survive.
To hear the whole interview, go to kboo.fm and search for bipolar DBT, peer counseling, oh my.
Triangle Productions and KBOO Community Radio are proud to present Kiss of the Spider Woman. The Oregon premiere of this 7-time Tony Award-winning musical will be at The Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. The show will run from September 5th through the 29th. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News.
Portland police arrest campers at an early morning altercation in downtown Portland.
A cleanup of the Marys River in Corvallis proceeds without water testing.
federal officials moved to delist gray wolves from the endangered species list. Advocacy groups.
Good evening. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, September 10th, 2013. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Nat Parker. Yesterday, local protesters in Portland, Beaverton, and Vancouver joined thousands of protesters in over 165 candlelight vigils in 41 states across the United States. President Obama's request to use military force in Syria ignited the protests. The vigils were hosted by MoveOn.org, Civil Action, Credo Action, Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and the Win Without War Coalition. Over 1,000 local and national news outlets covered the MoveOn's campaign against the use of military force in Syria. Anna Galland, executive director of MoveOn.org's Civic Action, said MoveOn's members have made it clear that they want a peaceful solution to the Syrian crisis. The vigils follow MoveOn's release of a 30-second television ad, quote, "Don't lead us down this road again." These ads will air this week on MSNBC, urging Congress to reject the authorization for use of military force in Syria.
A confrontation between Portland police and a group of campers in downtown Portland resulted in four arrests this morning. Police say they approached the group setting up tents on the sidewalk near Terry Schrunk Plaza early this morning and asked them to leave. According to a press release from the Portland police, the group became, quote, rowdy after police attempted to issue a jaywalking citation to one of the campers, who was arrested and charged with providing false information to the police. Other arrests include two women who were charged with assaulting police officers and one man who was charged with disorderly conduct for swinging a chain during the altercations. For more on this story, KABU's Rebecca Ney spoke with Thomas Howe, who witnessed and filmed part of the confrontation and the subsequent arrest of one of the campers.
Thomas, can you give us a detailed account of what you witnessed this morning, please?
Yeah, I was working late, and I was going down Madison towards the Hawthorne Bridge, and I'd seen folks camped out in the public square area for, I would say, the last couple of weeks. I don't know if they were connected with Occupy or not. I don't know what their situation was, but I'd seen them before. They'd always been peaceful, so I was very, very surprised and a little bit alarmed to see a number of police cars and quite a scene developing just as I drove by. And I slowed down going through the intersection, and there was an incredible amount of yelling and just a lot of unpleasantness. And I saw police leading away one gentleman, and there were just a lot of folks yelling, and the tension was immediately so thick and disconcerting that I thought I should stop because it looked like things were about to explode. It was very alarming, and so I, like any good American these days, I got up my cell phone and started shooting video just to keep an eye on things, and, you know, sometimes that's not the worst thing either, because if people know they're being photographed, they tend to behave a little bit better, and that sort of goes for everyone. But no one really took much notice of me, but I videotaped a gentleman being led away and some people talking with police officers. There just seemed to be a general air of intimidation, but I don't know what had happened preceding that either.
Based on what you witnessed, who do you believe ignited this?
I do not know. I do know that I drove right in front of the police bureau on 2nd because I heard a woman screaming. And I went by and I drove by and I saw two officers holding a woman who was barely resisting arrest. And she was just wailing and obviously very unhappy. I don't know what the situation was. I don't know what happened prior to that. But I did see it looked like they just dropped her right on the pavement. And then she was sort of dazed, and they sort of draped her on this car, and then another police officer told me to started asking what I was doing, and clearly didn't want me there, you know, videotaping it.
That was Thomas Howe, a witness to the altercation this morning between Portland police and campers at Terry Schrunk Plaza. The arrest of four campers this morning is the latest in a string of incidents this summer involving a government crackdown on homeless campers in downtown Portland.
Federal wildlife officials are moving ahead with an experiment to see if killing a rival owl will help save the northern spotted owl from extinction. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said Tuesday it gave final approval to a plan to send trained hunters into the woods to shoot barred owls. Barred owls migrated from the east and arrived in spotted owl territory in 1959. Since then, the larger and more aggressive barred owls have dislodged many spotted owls from their nests. The agency says they have since become the biggest threat to spotted owl survival. Plans are to kill or capture barred owls in four study areas in Washington, Oregon, and Northern California over the next 4 years.
Yesterday, the Fish and Wildlife Service announced an extension for public comment regarding a proposal that would strip gray wolves of their federal protections. Some wildlife advocates worry that the proposal, if enacted, will set a dangerous precedent regarding the protection of other endangered species. Public hearings about the delisting of gray wolves are being held in Washington, D.C., Sacramento, and Albuquerque. For more, KBOO's Sean Stewart spoke with Rob Clavins, the wildlands and wildlife advocate from the nonprofit conservation group Oregon Wild.
What sparked the proposal to delist the gray wolves?
Good question. It seems like the Obama administration is set to become the second administration to declare mission accomplished a little bit too early. You know, though most Americans and most Oregonians value wolves and native wildlife, there's a small but vocal minority that still want to see wolves killed and wiped off the landscape. You know, old prejudices die hard, unfortunately. And I think it's largely a political decision. Wolf recovery and conservation is seen to some in Washington, D.C. as something of a headache. And unfortunately, rather than see the job through that was started when we passed the Endangered Species Act and reintroduced wolves into Yellowstone National Park in central Idaho in 1995, the administration seems far too willing to throw wolves to the Tea Party and are stripping them of critical protections that they still need. In Oregon, we have less than 50 known adult wolves in the entire state. So the idea that wolf recovery is done and the job has been finished is laughable if it weren't so serious.
What impact has the publication Places for Wolves had in past years on wolf conservation? And how do you feel it will impact the delisting proposal?
Science has shown that the critical and irreplaceable role that wolves play on the landscape. They're a long way from recovering. In Oregon, for instance, we have less than 50 known adult wolves in the entire state, and all but one are in the northeastern corner of the state. We only have one wolf west of the Cascades. That's OR7, the wolf often referred to as Journey. And science has told us that there is a lot of really good habitat in Oregon. The only peer-reviewed study I have seen on wolf habitat in Oregon said that in modern Oregon, there's enough habitat for over 1,000 wolves in the state. And here we are with the administration considering stripping wolves of federal protections where we have less than 50. The delisting of an endangered species is the sort of news that conservationists should celebrate. But unfortunately, what we've seen in other states is when wolves are delisted, wolves are managed, and manage is often a euphemism for kill, in ways that we never would consider with other species. For instance, when bald eagles and gray whales were taken off the endangered species list, we didn't reopen whaling stations on the coast or try to reduce eagle populations to bare minimums. But what we've seen in places like Idaho and Wyoming and Montana are efforts to reduce populations of wolves to absolute minimums, and we've seen over 1,000 wolves killed since they were stripped of protections there.
The Fish and Wildlife Service does not want to hold public hearings in Colorado, Oregon, or Washington, knowing about the habitat support for wolf recovery. Could you speak to me about this?
Yeah, it's frustrating. You know, as I said earlier, Americans and Oregonians overwhelmingly value native wildlife. They value wolves. They see wolves as a symbol of freedom and wilderness in the American West, and have a good understanding that they have an important role to play on the landscape. So it's really disappointing to see that not only did the administration ignore some of the best wolf scientists and wildlife scientists in the country who have argued that that delisting is a bad idea. It's unfortunate also to see the administration
not wanting to hear public comment. And I think that's it's not surprising when if you understand how overwhelmingly public sentiment is in favor of seeing wolf recovery stay on track and take hold. So the best evidence of the Obama administration not wanting to hear from the public who values native wildlife and wants to see wolf recovery take hold is the fact that they're holding only three public hearings in the entire country, one in Washington, D.C., where there aren't any wolves and probably won't be anytime soon, one in the Southwest, and then one in Sacramento. There's not a single hearing taking place in Oregon or Washington, places where wolves have a real great chance at recovery if they maintain those protections. Also places where the vast majority of people want to see wolf recovery take hold and stay on track. So if you live in Seattle, or you live in Portland, or you live in Eugene or Ashland, you have to get in your car or hop in a plane and go all the way to Sacramento, California, if you want to have your voice heard. And that's just an unfortunate demonstration of the Obama administration's intent to ignore the public support for wolves, and as well as the overwhelming science that says wolves play a critical and irreplaceable role in the landscape.
That was Rob Clavins from Oregon Wild speaking with KBOO's Sean Stewart about the potential impact and precedent of the federal government's plans to strip gray wolves of federal protections.
The cleanup of a contaminated section of the Marys River in Corvallis began this morning, a month after a Northwest Natural drilling operation spewed a large amount of bentonite into the water. Now Northwest Natural may be playing too great a role in the cleanup. KBOO's Miles Bryan reports.
Bentonite is known in the drilling business as drilling mud. It's an especially absorbent kind of clay that can lubricate drill bits and help flush out loose material during a drill. Northwest Natural is using bentonite to drill for its Corvallis Loop, a $17 million project to bury nearly 10 miles of gas line from Corvallis to Albany. Bentonite occurs naturally and does not affect humans, which makes it an appealing alternative to petroleum-based lubricants. But bentonite does have the potential to escape a drill line and rise to the surface, an event known as a frack out. Last month, bentonite escaped from a drill site in the Marys River in Corvallis. The frack out colored the Marys River a muddy green, and it caught the attention of Oregon's environmental regulatory agencies, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Department of Environmental Quality. They ordered Northwest Natural to clean up the spill, a process that got underway this week. But the government agencies have taken Northwest Natural at their word that only bentonite and water were released into the river. Elise Kelly is a biologist with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Her organization has been monitoring the effect of bentonite on the local fish population, but Kelly says they are not responsible for testing the water for other pollutants.
We are not the agency responsible for water quality testing or anything like that. That would be the Department of Environmental Quality. So that was not our call.
Renee Nomura is the spokesperson for Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality. She said that this time water testing wasn't necessary.
We don't test every release that occurs or spill that occurs in the state. If we think we have a good understanding of what happened and what chemicals are in question, and in this case, we did feel like we had a good handle on the situation and what was released, and we did have eyes and ears on the ground with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, so we felt it wasn't necessary to test.
That Northwest Natural was allowed to diagnose its own mess has concerned at least one Corvallis resident. In a letter to the Corvallis Gazette Times, Roger Paul said he was skeptical of Northwest Natural and Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality. The incident, he wrote, had him paraphrasing the Ghostbuster tagline, from who are you going to call to who are you going to trust. With KBOO, this is Miles Bryan.
Comcast has upped the speeds of its subsidized internet service program for low-income families in the Pacific Northwest. The Internet Essentials program provides internet access for about $10 a month, roughly a fifth of the regular price. The discounts are available to families whose children qualify for free or reduced school lunches. Internet Essentials offers downloads of 5 megabits per second, up from 1.5 megabits per second when the program launched in the fall of 2011. Additionally, Comcast offers a basic $150 computer through Internet Essentials to families that qualify for the program. The company said 6,300 families are participating in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Comcast agreed to offer the discounts for 3 years as a condition of federal approval for its purchase of NBC Universal and is currently evaluating whether to extend it beyond that period.
You are listening to the KBOO KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after this newscast, followed by Out Loud, Queer Culture Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny, with a high of 95 degrees.
It's 5:20. Time for the daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
What amazing alchemists Wall Street bankers are. They can turn failure into gold and reform into business as usual. These sorcerers have pulled off both tricks right in front of us since their 2007 collapse. They turned that gross failure into an ongoing multi-trillion dollar bailout by us taxpayers to restore them to even grosser profit levels. Then, while the public howled for lawmakers to shackle their greed, these bewitching bankers reached into their magic hat and pulled out the massive Dodd-Frank reform law that, hocus-pocus, adds up to the status quo. And, as a West Texas farmer once told me, status quo is Latin for the mess we're in. Wall Street's greatest deception is the claim that they're brave risk-takers who put their money into enterprises that create America's economic growth. Bovine excrement. One, as we've seen, they're not investing in enterprises. They're frittering away America's investment funds on ridiculous get-rich-quick gambling schemes. Second, they're not risking their money or that of their shareholders, but ours. When we deposit money with Chase, Bank of America, etc., we make a practically zero-interest loan to them that they take to global gambling tables. Of the $2.4 trillion held by J.P. Morgan Chase, for example, $2.2 trillion is borrowed from us. It's our cash they're risking. And when their convoluted gambles fail, as in 2007, everything collapses, and they'll run to Washington again demanding a bailout. So the reform that matters is to make them put, say, half of their own money into each roll of the dice, rather than piling 90% of each risk on our backs. But does the Dodd-Frank reform law do that? No, it allows banks to stack 95% of their risk on us. This is Jim Hightower saying, that is Wall Street's dirtiest trick yet.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Hawaii Governor Neil Abercrombie on Monday called for a special legislative session to move forward a bill that would legalize gay marriage in the Aloha state. If lawmakers pass a bill, Hawaii would join 13 U.S. states and the District of Columbia in allowing gay marriage. Hawaii is already among a handful of states that allow same-sex civil unions, which marriage equality advocates say stops short of the full benefits of marriage. Proponents of marriage equality in the state renewed their efforts after seeing two U.S. Supreme Court rulings in their favor in June. A draft of the bill being proposed, released by Abercrombie's office last month, proposes that Hawaii begin issuing marriage licenses next month. If passed, ceremonies could begin in November.
U.S. senators held a first-ever hearing aimed at reconciling rapidly changing state marijuana laws with a federal prohibition on the drug. The hearing before the State Judiciary Committee follows a Justice Department memo outlining how it will enforce federal marijuana prohibitions in two states, Colorado and Washington, that have legalized its use, and 20 other states that allow marijuana for medical use. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont argued that the criminalization of marijuana had led to a rising prison population that disproportionately impacts people of color, among other negative outcomes. Speaking in opposition to the loosening of federal enforcement, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa said Colorado had done a poor job so far of preventing marijuana exports to other states where marijuana remains illegal. The Justice Department said in an August 29th memo to U.S. attorneys nationwide that it would seek only to prosecute people for certain infractions of federal law. Those violations include selling marijuana to minors, using state laws as a cover for drug trafficking, or attempting to distribute marijuana in states where it is not legal.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
As labor activists and union leaders meeting in Los Angeles look for tactics and strategies that will succeed in revitalizing the labor movement, an inspiring example has come from an unlikely location, Orange County, California. For decades, it has been a Republican-dominated conservative area, and yet Tafare Gubre has managed to lead a robust local labor movement in that county. The Ethiopian immigrant is about to become the new vice president of the AFL-CIO. He says labor can win for workers even in places like Orange County and also in southern states, which have long been hostile to unions.
If we can do it in Orange County, there is no reason why we cannot do it in Mississippi, why we cannot do it in Alabama, why we cannot do it in Texas.
Gubre says that working people can only improve their lives through organized power, worker power not dependent on laws or on politicians or on politics.
It is bringing people together and saying, we have to realize our own power. We can't count on politicians or pollsters or consultants to deliver that power for us. That's what we have done in Orange County, and that's what we're going to do in Texas, Arizona, Alabama, South Carolina. I mean, I am excited about re-affiliating and re-bringing the South into the labor movement and not writing it off.
Maria Elena Durazo, Secretary Treasurer of the Los Angeles County AFL-CIO, says immigration reform is supported by the broadest, deepest majority coalition seen in many years. And she says Congress has no excuse not to deliver on immigration reform with a path to citizenship.
Don't put us on the back burner again. Don't put us under the pile. Don't come up with excuses. We don't care what else is going on. You have no excuse.
Durazo says the coalition remains committed and will escalate actions to support immigration reform. On Tuesday, representatives from the International Domestic Workers Alliance joined forces with union members, U.S. and California Domestic Workers Alliances, as they asserted a domestic workers' bill of rights at the AFL-CIO convention. They urged passage of a California bill giving that bill of rights the force of law. Domestic workers are currently excluded from many basic labor law protections that the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights would grant them. New York and Hawaii have already passed domestic worker Bill of Rights laws. Massachusetts is considering a similar bill. At the Los Angeles AFL-CIO convention, celebrating more than 25 years of action by Jobs with Justice to support worker rights, CWA President Larry Cohen said that the struggle for social and economic justice for workers is powered by unwavering solidarity. He said activists should know that despite daunting odds, the cause is not hopeless.
No matter how hard it is, know it's not hopeless. And know that the love and solidarity that we have together allow us to go on and one day longer.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I'm sorry, that was not the Palestine update, but instead was the Workers Independent News Network.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, two roadside bombs killed 11 people on Tuesday, including passengers on a bus that took a detour to avoid a bomb-laden road, officials said. Roadside bombs are a major threat to civilians in Afghanistan, where Taliban resistance fighters have escalated their activities as U.S.-led foreign forces withdraw. A bus traveling to Kabul from southern Helmand province had to take a desert path because the road it would have normally used was closed to allow NATO troops to defuse a roadside bomb. Instead, the bus hit another such explosive along its detour in the Ghazni province, officials said. The seven dead included three children, while 17 people were wounded in the explosion. You're listening. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Rosalyn Scott, Miles Bryan, Robin Ryan, Sean Stewart, and Rebecca Ney. The producer is Christian Danielson. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Nat Parker. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, Lisa Loving hosts a call-in discussion on the anniversary of 9/11. At 9 on Political Perspectives, host Per Fegerang interviews professor and activist Rania Masri about Syria, quote, beyond the falsehoods and false choices, a reaction to Obama's speech. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 11, it's on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Anderson welcomes John Salviette to talk about his food forest and unusual fruits and his grafting experiments. And quince. He knows quince. Thanks to KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now stay tuned for more national and international news from the Worker-Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks for listening. Good night, Nate.
Good night, Diane.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 10th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Syria's government agrees to a Russian-backed arms proposal as U.S. lawmakers continue to debate authorizing military force in the country. Voters in Colorado go to the polls for a recall election that's being seen as a test for both gun control efforts and the recall process itself. And we go to Nicaragua, where women advocates fight to preserve a landmark law to protect women from violence. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. An Indian court today convicted four men for last year's gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old woman in New Delhi. The incident in December sparked national outrage, forcing the government to introduce tougher anti-rape laws. FSRN's Bismillah Gilani reports.
The judge of the special fast-track court in New Delhi announced his verdict in a jam-packed courtroom. He convicted the four men of rape and murder. There were six accused in the case. One allegedly committed suicide in prison, while another, a minor, was tried in a juvenile court. The men will be sentenced Wednesday. Outside the court, the clamor is growing for the death penalty. Ranjana Kumari is a women's rights activist.
This should be sending a message across to the country that such gruesome act on women will not be tolerated. Any form of sexual assault is unacceptable by our society, and all the criminals should get the message that they will not be spared.
Anti-sexual assault laws introduced following the Delhi gang rape haven't changed much on the ground. According to the latest government figures, a woman is raped in India every 20 minutes. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Today's conviction comes as a new survey of six Asian countries found that about one in four men had committed rape, although the term rape was not used in framing the questions. The UN study of 10,000 men covered Bangladesh, Cambodia, China, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and Papua New Guinea. It suggests a culture of male entitlement to sex was a major factor in the individual motivation to commit sexual violence. The Romanian prime minister says parliament won't support legislation that would have streamlined approval of a massive gold mining project in the Transylvanian mountains. Last week, FSRN reported thousands of people were protesting the proposed Rocha Montana project because of potential for environmental damage, the desire to preserve cultural heritage of the region, and the desire for more national control of Romania's natural resources. The legislation would have given the state a larger controlling interest in the project. In Turkey, protesters clashed with police in cities across the country today following the death of a 22-year-old demonstrator in the early hours of the morning. The Taksim Solidarity Platform, one of the main groups behind the Gezi Park actions, called on people to protest the death, allegedly at the hands of police. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from Istanbul.
There are conflicting reports on what killed 22-year-old Ahmet Atakan, a university student in the city of Antakya. Eyewitnesses say he was killed by a gas canister fired at close range by police, while authorities allege he fell from a building. Atakan had been protesting a controversial road project that would cut through a university campus's green space in the capital, Ankara. Following calls for renewed demonstrations, thousands of police sealed off Taksim Square and Gezi Park in anticipation of further unrest. Onur, a 36-year-old travel agent, arrived at the square with friends. He says police violence in Turkey cannot go unanswered.
Most of the people, they are killed by the police and they are shot in a very close distance, 5 meters, 4 meters, and they just shoot them in purpose. So we think that it's not an accident, it's not a coincidence, so they are killed for a purpose. So that's why we are here.
As dusk fell, police fired tear gas while small groups of demonstrators hurled objects. There are reports of similar unrest in other cities, echoing the spread of Gezi Park protests last spring. Dissatisfaction with government plans to replace green space with commercial development remains a symbolic rallying call for demonstrators who complain of creeping authoritarianism in Turkey. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
New York City residents went to the polls today in this year's Democratic Party primary, choosing candidates for a host of seats, including mayor. FSRN's Peter Rue spoke to New Yorkers near polling stations in Brooklyn and filed this report.
Hot-button issues in this year's elections include health care, affordable housing, and the widely perceived racial bias by the New York police force. However, most voters FSRN spoke to said the economy tops their list. Jennifer Worth is an unemployed marketing professional in her mid-30s. Her concerns over the city's increasing income disparity led her to back Bill de Blasio, who currently holds the elected office of public advocate.
I was really heartened in a sad way that people like Bill de Blasio were actually using words like talking about the working class and the poor and actually acknowledging that those people exist.
A Quinnipiac University poll ahead of the election put de Blasio just shy of the 40% tally he needs to prevent a runoff vote. De Blasio would be a sharp departure after the 12-year reign of the city's current mayor, billionaire Michael Bloomberg, widely criticized for cutting basic services and for presiding over New York's increasing wealth gap. Third-party candidates, including the Green Party's Anthony Gronowitz, will also be on ballots this November. Peter Rue, FSRN, Brooklyn.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Charlotte, North Carolina, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Syria's foreign minister said today the Assad government was open to a Russian-backed proposal to turn over its chemical weapons stockpile to the international community in order to deter the United States from taking military action. In response, U.S. senators delayed a vote originally scheduled for Wednesday on giving President Obama permission to use military force. But the president and his administration are continuing their lobbying blitz today ahead of a primetime speech this evening, pushing a reluctant Congress to authorize a military strike as a means of keeping the pressure on the Syrian government to negotiate. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
The Syrian government has agreed to a proposal from Russia to give up its chemical weapons and sign the international ban prohibiting them, which President Obama said could be a breakthrough. France is drafting a parallel UN Security Council resolution on Syria's chemical weapons, which could still authorize a military response if its conditions are not met. These diplomatic overtures have won the support of China, the Arab League, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and several lawmakers on Capitol Hill.
If something can be done diplomatically, I'm totally satisfied with that.
I am excited.
And if you can put diplomacy before war, we're all ears.
I believe it's a good path forward.
That was Majority Leader Harry Reid, Vermont Independent Bernie Sanders, West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin, and California Democrat Dianne Feinstein. Feinstein, who supported striking Syria before these developments, told FSRN that she disagrees with the Obama administration's suggestion that the Russian proposal could be a ploy or delaying tactic.
I had lunch yesterday with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. We spent at least an hour on just this subject. The ambassador assured me that this is a serious effort.
But these diplomatic developments are not stopping the administration's push for a war resolution. President Obama, Secretary of State John Kerry, and Pentagon Chief Chuck Hagel all came to Capitol Hill Tuesday to press members of Congress to authorize the use of military force against Syria. In a hearing before the House Armed Services Committee, Kerry argued that this would somehow help the diplomatic process.
A lot of people say that nothing focuses the mind like the prospect of a hanging. Well, it's the credible threat of force that has been on the table for these last weeks that has, for the first time, brought this regime to even acknowledge that they have a chemical weapons arsenal. And it is the threat of this force and our determination to hold Assad accountable that has motivated others to even talk about a real and credible international action that might have an impact. So how do you maintain that pressure? We have to continue to show Syria, Russia, and the world that we are not going to fall for stalling tactics.
But Russian President Vladimir Putin told Russia Today that the diplomatic solution would only work if the U.S. renounces its efforts to strike the Syrian government, saying a nation under threat of attack cannot be expected to voluntarily disarm. Many lawmakers also remain unconvinced. Feinstein told FSRN that the president shouldn't push Congress to pass anything until they know where the UN negotiations are headed. And Vermont Independent Bernie Sanders said it was appropriate for the Senate to put a vote on the war authorization on hold. He said 95% of the constituents calling and emailing his office are opposed to any U.S. intervention.
I think the American people are speaking loudly about it. I think actually every once in a while democracy actually works, not very often around here. And the Congress is hearing that message. I don't think the president has support in the Congress to go forward.
As UN Security Council negotiations continue and senators work on crafting a new resolution in light of the developments, President Obama will address the public at 9 p.m. Eastern Tuesday night about the ongoing conflict in Syria and what actions he believes the United States should take. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The ongoing conflict in Syria is having deep impacts on the children of the country as they cope with displacement, loss of friends and family, and extended bouts of violence and stress. According to UNICEF, more than 4 million children in Syria are affected by the fighting, and after 2.5 years of conflict, they are showing signs of the heavy toll. Marixi Mercado is UNICEF's spokesperson in Geneva.
Children who have undergone profound stress can lose the ability to connect emotionally to others and to themselves. Basic feelings can stop, and children can find themselves unable to think ahead or remember recent events. The way children describe what is happening inside Syria is now changing. They speak about a different kind of war. They speak about different weapons, but without a true understanding of what they mean. It also shows that adults and the elders that children are listening to are so profoundly stressed themselves and have been for such a long time that they are no longer able to monitor what they say in front of children.
UNICEF said it has reached nearly 500,000 children in the region with psychological support and other assistance, but nutrition, safe water, and health services continue to be urgent needs for Syria's children. As the humanitarian crisis continues, powerful regional players are vying for influence in the conflict. The roles that Turkey, Iran, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and others are playing could weigh heavily on a peaceful resolution to the crisis. For more, the Real News Network spoke with Patrick Coburn, longtime Middle East correspondent, currently with The Independent, who reported from Damascus this summer. He spoke to The Real News' Jessica Devereaux.
So, Patrick, let's talk about an actor that doesn't get much media attention in this whole ramp up to a potential strike against Syria, that being Saudi Arabia. What, in your opinion, are the motives for Saudi Arabia to be funding the opposition, and what's really driving their agenda?
Well, Saudi Arabia has always had difficult relations with Syria. Not every year, but a lot of the time. They really don't like Syria being allied to Iran. Iran is the great rival of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. And, you know, Saudi Arabia isn't just Sunni, but it's fundamentalist Sunni and regards the Shia and the leadership of Syria, or Alawites, they're sort of Shia, as being basically heretics. So you have the Saudis seeing this as a way of getting at Iran and also driving back the Shia. Those are probably the main motives of the Saudi monarchy.
Okay. And what about Qatar? They're also funding the opposition. Is it for very similar reasons that they're fighting against Assad?
They had supported the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and Syria, which the Saudis don't like. There's rivalry there, although they have a lot in common. And the Qataris are now playing a lesser role. They were playing a bigger role previously in supporting and financing the opposition. And they also have great influence through the Al Jazeera satellite channel. This played a crucial role at the beginning of the Arab Spring and still plays a pretty significant role as one of the main media outlets in both Arabic and English in the region.
Okay, and what about Turkey? What's their role in all this?
The Turks began with a very good hand, to my mind, and they played it pretty badly. They had good relations with Assad. They had good relations with reasonable relations with the U.S. They turned against Assad when he didn't take their advice. They support the rebels.